You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Coming up on today's episode, Bruce and I dive deep into Operation Varsity Blues and talk about David Beatty's lawsuit against Kansas and answer all of your email questions. That's next on the Audible. Welcome to the Audible presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman. I have a question, Bruce. Did you get into Miami on your own merits, or did somebody pay a bribe?
Stu, I don't know anybody who can do that. This story I know we're going to talk about, which I'm referring to as now Aunt Becky Gate, because it involved Lori Loughlin. I think that the Lori Loughlin Felicity Huffman angle of this got it, I think, a lot of attention. But when I first started looking at this, I'm like, you know, this is not a surprise at all to me that something like this happens. Now, the layers of it are really kind of fascinating. But I think the aspect of rich people, I mean, we see this all a lot of times with famous politicians and big business people basically buying their kids way into educations and degrees that they probably would never have been able to get if it was based on their own academic merits.
I think that this really touches on so many themes that are already, there's already a lot of backlash in this country. People who are going to be running for president are putting this central to their platform about inequality and privilege of the wealthy. And this just really hits all
of that. It stinks of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So you said it doesn't surprise me that, you know, wealthy people would be trying to game the system to get their kids into college. What I think really, because you know, you mentioned the Hollywood part of it. When this story broke pretty early on the West Coast, I wish I could give credit, but I don't remember who the reporter was that did it first. But his first tweet was, you know, massive indictments coming today, and Division I coaches are involved. So that's what got our attention. Like, whoa! And you're thinking that could be football coaches or basketball coaches. And then the next one was like, and two of the people arrested are Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman. And you're going, how on earth could those be connected? Well, you know, I guess the thing I would not have guessed or realized is that there would be this pretty involved scheme in which, and these are in many cases very prominent head coaches of Olympic sport teams at major universities. The water polo coach at USC, who got arrested and fired on Tuesday, 16 national championships. And the idea that, and by the way, this is probably just the tip of the iceberg. I'm sure they didn't catch everybody that's done this, that it was almost like a side income for a lot of these coaches, like who, by the way, are not making Nick Saban money or even, you know, Mac football head coach money. You can make a little extra money by helping some Hollywood actor's daughter get into college. And really, just in the most corrupt way possible. I mean, and it's not clear that this was the case in every situation, but certainly in some, you know, they're basically allocating a scholarship from the, you know, off of their own team's scholarship count to get some kid who doesn't even play the sport into college. So I think that's the part, at least in our world, that really sends shockwaves. There's a IMG Academy who sends tons of kids to college, play college football and basketball. One of their own employees was taking tests for kids. While there wasn't a lot of direct college football mentioned in there, it certainly reverberates in our world.
How cynical, and then maybe I know the answer to this because I can feel it myself. You know, you and I have talked about this quite a bit when it comes to, quote, scandals. And you look and go, all right, well, because of the Jerry Sandusky stuff with Penn State, it has recalibrated how we think of things. And you just kind of shrug your shoulders at some of this of kids getting extra benefits and extra meals or whatnot. When it comes to this, it is a bad look. And there's obviously, you know, millions of dollars we're talking about in bribe. But I think in knowing the landscape of how our country works. And that expression, because this came up, I've had conversations with people in the last day or so where it's like, this is just another reminder. It's not what you know, it's who you know. And I think you look at every aspect of our society, never mind Hollywood, you look at just how our country works. This is nothing surprising about that. That's why I kind of always look and go, you know what? Every rock we overturn, there's crap to it.
I think it's an enormous scandal. It's, you know, as I wrote on Tuesday, you know, a lot of people have kind of rolled their eyes or been apathetic toward the college basketball FBI scandal, even though there have already been people who are sentenced to prison over it. Because at the end of the day, if you're somebody who thinks the NCAA rules are stupid and the players should be getting paid anyway, then it's hard to be outraged that this is being classified as bribery. You know, the shoe executive or the runner, that they're going to jail for giving an athlete's family money. I get that. But this is not specific to athletics. And there's a difference. Like, for instance, people said, well, rich people have always been able to get their kids into college, right, by donating a building. Okay, well, that's legal. This is not. This is outright fraud.
That's legal, but it still comes at the expense of other kids who are probably more deserving.
Yes, true. But, you know, I think that, in other words, there is some gray area in the basketball scandal if people want to say, well, I don't think what's going on here should even be considered unethical. I would say the way I look at it is I don't fault the families who are getting money in that situation, but I do fault that. I mean, Will Wade is a multi-million dollar coach who knows better. You know, if he's caught cheating, whether you agree with the rules or not, when he gets caught cheating, he should be held accountable. But there's no gray area in this. Everybody that was involved, the senior associate AD at USC, who is literally creating fake profiles of athletes and then taking them into the athletics, admissions subcommittee and getting them enrolled. And then after they get accepted, oh, they came down with a mystery injury and they're not going to play anymore. Like, that's fraud of the highest degree. And
well, let's talk about her. Yeah. It's Donna Heinel, and she's really the highest level athletics person who is ensnared in this at this point. And here's what her role is or was. Like, pretty much all the transfers of recruits that USC is going to try to get in, she's the one who goes in front of the board and makes the case. Now, what I think is interesting subplot to this, maybe subplot is too loaded a word, but USC, I think, admits about 3,000 freshmen a year, obviously not just student athletes, that's everybody, and they get, I don't know, 50,000 students apply. From everything I've heard, it's like, in a lot of cases, it helps to know people there to get into that. It's almost a lottery at that point, right? And so the level of influence and the bribes here, I mean, I think there's two layers to this. And one of the things I know you wrote about and a lot of people have written about, and quite honestly, it's something that we had Ryan Abraham, USCfootball.com on this podcast about a month ago. And, you know, I talked to somebody who knows how USC works, and the word they described is it's basically a shit show in the way that place now operates and has been operating for a while. And you certainly, you know, where is Lynn Swann and where is the accountability? So I think there's so many layers to this. As I said before, the USC layer is certainly one that is going to be out front. And then there's the big picture of this scandal as it is, as much as it's athletics, but I feel like it's just another lesson into the, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And unfortunately, this is fair or unfair, and it's certainly not fair, but this is a slice of how the country seems to work in a lot of cases.
So the guy who was the ringleader of the whole thing, who pleaded guilty on Tuesday, and I guess is trying to get a reduced sentence, he turned and started working for the prosecutors at some point, you know, described it very succinctly. He said there's a front door, which is, you know, legitimate, apply to college and get accepted or not. And there's a back door, which is your family donates a lot of money and hopefully that wields influence. I created a side door, which it was so appealing because it was a guarantee. Like, there's not going to be any question here. He knows what numbers it's going to take, you know, SAT grade point wise to get past the admissions committee, and we'll just make it happen. And then we'll fake a picture of your kid playing water polo or There's so many great nuggets in that, and I haven't even really read the whole thing yet, but there's so many great nuggets that people have highlighted, like the kid who they took a picture of him supposedly playing water polo, and he's like, nobody can get that high up in the air playing water polo. What are you doing? What's wrong with that picture? He's like, oh, he was standing in the pool. Just the absurdity of all this. So you're right. It's in many ways a lottery at some of these upper level schools. I found it fascinating the amount of money involved in some, like, clearly the prices seem to vary based on the prestige level of the school. Like the one who tried to got their kid into Yale, that was $1.2 million bribe. And then some others, it was, you know, $100,000 or $50,000. I mentioned earlier the IMG Academy tie-in. To me, this is pretty significant in the recruiting world. This guy, Mark Riddell, basically his role at IMG was he was the person who was, you know, the basically like the guidance counselor for college admissions. So all of these recruits that would come through IMG and would apply to colleges, he's the one that facilitated that. Well, also, he was going to Houston and taking tests. He's 36 years old, and he's going to Houston taking tests for these clients that were of the parents who were paying the money. In some cases, he would change the answers afterward. They had a guy in Houston who was, you know, complicit in this. I got to think that raises some attention with compliance people, maybe with the NCAA clearinghouse, that, well, if he was doing this for other kids, how do we know he wasn't doing this for IMG's own recruits?
No, I think these are valid questions to ask. Would you feel a little differently about this if, let's say you have, in the case of Lori Loughlin's husband is a famous designer. I don't know how much money he's worth, but he's worth a ton, right? And thinking about this, and you think about, like, okay, people have generational wealth. A lot of these kids probably would never have to work real jobs as adults, right? I mean, if some of the parents can afford to do some of this, if you'd say, okay, you know what, USC, you know, we're just going to give you straight up, you know, $1.2 million. Our child is going to go there, but it's not going to be at the cost of another student. Meaning if you're going to take 3,000 freshmen, you take 3,050. And these other 50 students are going to be enrolled. It's not to say that they're going to take fake classes, but if they can, you know, they're going to pay for their admissions, but it's not coming at the enrollment cap of 50 other students who don't have that kind of influence or that kind of financial resources. Do you look at it differently?
No, it's a very tangible issue, right? You only have a certain number of classrooms and you only have a certain number of dorm rooms. And, you know, I know it's a little bit like, they handle it a little, they have to do it in some ways. They have to handle it a little bit like an airline, you know, like an airplane gets overbooked. They accept a certain number of kids and then they're basically waiting to see what percentage of them accept. I have seen situations where I've definitely read about situations over the years where more people accepted than they were expecting and they didn't have enough dorm rooms, you know? So they tend to manage that pretty conservatively.
Yeah. Well, but here's the thing though, if you're one of these students, you have this kind of money, you can afford to live wherever you want.
Oh, I see. So you're saying they should just go ahead and just be upfront about it and create like a parallel admission system.
You know, like 18-year-old Rodney Dangerfield in this school. Let them, you know, like, again, there's going to be a grown-up who's going to sit right into our podcast and go, no, this is why you can't do that. I'm just saying, if you have that kind of money, they don't need to live in a dorm. I feel like the part that bothered me about this story is that it came at the expense of some other students who don't have those means, and don't have it come at the expense of those students because this went on. If the school wants that much money, let them negotiate that kind of deal and say, all right, you're not part of this enrollment process, but you can still be a quote unquote student here. Now, are we going to give you free grades? I mean, you're already talking about a level that seems like it was a scam. So I don't know. Does that devalue the education? I mean, it already seems like some of these students would devalue the education, whether they're on the up and up or not.
I don't know. And we haven't even touched the fact that, and I thought this was the part that would probably take off the most, but I'm not seeing that yet. Just there was a reason they steered these kids to the athletics, right? It's just a known fact that it's easier to get in if you're an athlete than if you're not. that these schools lower their standards for athletes. And like, we've always known that, it's not a secret. But this kind of,
I think people are surprised that it's not scholarship athletes, though.
It's unclear if whether they are or not.
Right, but I'm saying if you're using that, so here's a kind of a real time analogy. So there was, I did that offensive line story for The Athletic, I don't know, 2 months ago, and one of the players in there was initially committed to Yale, and he ended up signing with Duke, and a lot of big schools, big football schools, got in on him late. He was a late bloomer. And I had reached out to somebody at USC and said, how did you guys kind of hear about this kid who's from Ohio? And was told, well, once they saw he was committed to Yale, they look at Ivy League commits because they see them as potential walk-ons. And a lot of times I think they see walk-ons, certainly will have, if they're Ivy League kids, will have the academics to get in, or at least close to get in, but also they would, in a lot of cases, probably be able to afford to come to USC as walk-ons, which it's a private school, and it's harder to get some of those kids than it is for a state school. So I think there's some layers in there that kind of explain some of that process. But I think the fact that, let's say you were a student, and you were a decent student, but not good enough to get into USC, but do you preferential treatment because they view you as a recruitable athlete, even if you're not on scholarship? I think that's what changes that.
At the end of the day, I think the reason this story touches such a nerve is that it affects so many people. Millions and millions of people in this country have gone through. I went through it. You know, anybody that's gone to college has gone through this very, you know, you're 17 years old and you feel like your whole future depends on getting into a certain college. And it's so, you take the SAT, you got to get a certain score. It's extremely stressful, and this confirms everybody's worst suspicion that basically the system is rigged. That no matter how great your essay is, no matter how many National Honor Society or how many volunteer work you've done, et cetera, that you might still not get accepted, and some kid whose parent bribed the rowing coach does. You know, whereas a scandal like the college basketball one, at the end of the day, it's a very, very small part of the population that's had a son or daughter recruited to be a high-level athlete. But lots and lots of people have gone through the college admissions process, and this just lays bare that it's extremely corrupt. And like I said before, I don't think it's just the people that they caught. These are the people that happen to be on, got caught on a wiretap. Chances are this goes on a lot more places, that it's probably other non-revenue coaches have done much of the same thing. So I assume there's going to be investigations, congressional investigations. I would think the NCAA is going to have to go back and start looking at, amongst their current athletes, going to have to probably start going back and looking at test scores and applications from people who either play, went through this, I don't know, that they think might have a connection to it, especially the IMG part. So I don't think this story's going away anytime soon, though I do think maybe the Full House jokes will pass. The Aunt Becky jokes will pass at some point.
All right. Well, I think we've talked about this plenty. What else is on your mind this week?
Well, it was a very newsy day. The day that this broke, there were like three or four other big stories in our world. David Beatty, who Kansas fired in November of last season, is suing Kansas for $3 million, which he says he is owed buyout money. Anytime a coach is fired for just not winning enough games, that's considered being fired without cause. And so whatever it says in the contract that you owe him, you owe him. But apparently they have not been paying him the $3 million. As these things often happen, the story comes out first from the plaintiff side, and the law firm was sure to highlight a quote, and we're still not sure where it came from, that they were, quote, looking for skeletons in the closet. Basically, looking to see if he has a dead hooker in his closet, was the quote, so they can get out of paying it. They can fire him with cause. Then Kansas puts out their statement saying, well, actually, we found out during the course of exit interviews with his staff that there may have been some NCAA violations, and we're investigating it. And as long as that's going on, the money has been set aside in escrow. We're not paying it yet. Two sides to the story. Any early hunch who you believe?
I'm going to lean towards David Beatty on this one, because they didn't fire him with cause initially. They said something came up. It's like, what becomes a fireable offense? Clearly, there's a lot of money Kansas is trying to save here. And they're trying, they're going to try to find a reason now after the fact. But if they find a reason, is it just is it just any violation that they would deem, well, that's enough for us to get our $3 million and not have to pay him? By the way, keep in mind, Kansas could be in a really precarious situation with the basketball scandal as that is playing out, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so there's a lot of things going on here, but I don't know. I mean, there better be a significant violation, a major infraction, if Kansas is going to try to justify this after the fact. And also, I think the fact that they have put out that this investigation part of it, I mean, it makes it harder for David Beatty to get an assistant coach job someplace else if he's in limbo for this. And also if there's the potential for some kind of violation that was so significant that that's why he was fired. I don't know. It's probably not the book for Jeff Long, the KUAD right now.
Well, unless, like you said, it turns out that there was some really legit violation under his watch that, you know, if he hadn't been losing, they would have fired him for cause anyway. It really looks petty. And it's interesting the perception of Jeff Long, who, you know, was the original chairman of the football selection committee, was held in very high esteem for that. Actually, before that, I think where he really got on the map nationally was when he fired Bobby Petrino, because it was seen as, at Arkansas, it was seen as one of those moments where the guy, you know, he was winning a lot of games. He was bringing success to Arkansas that they hadn't seen in a long time. And there are many situations where the AD would have found a reason to keep him, even though there was a pretty egregious ethical violation, basically, that he had. But Jeff Long fired him. I remember when Brett Bielema got hired, he cited that press conference as, like, having watched that press conference, I had somebody I might want to work for. So held in very high esteem. Then he gets fired from Arkansas. The Boosters basically run him out. He resurfaces at Kansas. He hires Les Miles in a hire that, obviously, I've been very down on, but I'm not alone. You know, I think a lot of people in the profession are like, what was he thinking? And now this. It's not a good look.
No, we'll have to see. I mean, I don't want to jump the gun too far. We'll have to see what comes of it in this legal battle. It's usually one that nobody wins, though, because I think it's the kind of thing where, you know, you said we'll see how legitimate there is. If there's a violation there, it wouldn't be surprising. It's the question of how significant is the actual violation. There's plenty of secondary violations, or what used to be known as secondary violations, that go on. The question is, can you justify firing a head coach and not paying them for that? To me, that's something that's going to be interesting to see.
What else has caught your attention this week?
Well, Kyler Murray had his pro day as we're taping this earlier this morning. As expected, he looked good, because usually quarterbacks do look good in their pro day and what's scripted and everything like that. Again, I think, and you and I have talked about this before, I think Kyler Murray is going to be a big, big storyline till then. But at this point right now, I got to admit, it feels like the NFL has done a really good job with its free agency, and certainly trades play into that, being a constant storyline. And it feels like that, as much as anything else, has kind of lived on. One thing, before we get to the mailbag, one thing I did want to point out was I got an interesting series of texts this morning from a football coach I know who took issue with both of us for our top 25 coaches list from last week. And I'm going to read you some of this stuff. And this person said, I was yelling at both you and Stu in the car this morning as I listened to that. And you know what he was most irritated about?
Kirk Ferentz.
Kirk Ferentz, but especially Paul Christ.
Was he irked about Kirk Ferentz?
What's that?
Was he really irked about Kirk Ferentz?
Yeah, Kirk Ferentz was the first one, and then Paul Chris. What else does he have to do for you guys? And so I said, well, who would you have taken off? And his answer was, I would knock out Dino Babers and Jeff Brohm. I think you have to win consistently with the big boys. He also took real issue with you not having Jim Harbaugh anywhere on your list. He goes, if I'm ranking him, he would have Jim Harbaugh in his top 10.
Kind of sounds like this is a Big Ten coach, not going to lie. Every single coach he's upset about is in the Big Ten.
That is fair. This is a person who has spent time in several places, but the Big Ten is one of them.
Well, I will say that our mailbag session this week is going to start with people who took issue with the list, and that's to be expected. You know, you rank 25 people, people have opinions, some people are going to... I can't imagine there's many people who read a column like that and go, yep, I agree with all 25. So, let's dig into the mailbag. As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. Regular listener and reader Jerry Swider says, Guys, your discussion touched on several of the significant differences between your two rankings, but ignored Dan Mullen, who I have at 13 and you have at 24. Mike Gundy, difference of 18 and 23. And Kyle Whittingham, difference of 23 and 17. Did you do any pre-podcast pinning to decide which differences merited discussion, or did you just wing it when the microphones were turned on? Well, first of all, Jerry, you should know we're always just winging it when the microphones are on. You think we put any sort of planning into this thing? Come on.
I honestly didn't realize, I don't think there's a huge gap between where you and I had Gundy and Whittingham. I didn't look at yours and go, because I feel like you respect Kyle Whittingham quite a bit. I'm a little surprised that now seeing it at 23, I didn't really kind of, you know, notice it when I looked at your list. But I don't think that's a huge gap, nor do I don't think Mike Gundy is a huge gap. Dan Mullen is a sizable one. I can see that's 11 spots. You and I have talked about that a little bit. I mean, to me, my case for why Dan Mullen is not a top 15 coach compared to some of those other guys is he coached almost a decade at Mississippi State. He was there 9 years, two top 20 finishes. He had a really good first year at Florida, though. But if you look at what he did relative to Jackie Sherrill at Mississippi State, I don't think it was right. You know, he didn't blow the doors. He did a really nice job at a tough place in a tough division. But it wasn't like, you know, he had them in the top 15 a lot. So that's my issue. You know, you look at what Mike Leach did. Mike Leach was, I think, number 10 on my list. And he's won at really tough places. And he's done more at really tough places. So that was kind of my rationale on that.
I have a lot of respect for Mullen. I think his teams, yeah, they weren't playing for national championships, but they often overachieved at Mississippi State. Mississippi State produced Dak Prescott. You know, Dan Mullen has a long history now of this. And then he comes into Florida. I wouldn't have had him quite as high last year, but then he does go to a blue blood program and immediately improves them from 4 wins to 10 wins. And Felipe Franks, who seemed kind of hopeless the year before, suddenly is a decent quarterback. So I think it's one of those things, and I know that I tend to maybe overemphasize the overachievers, but it's just one of those things where I feel like it's easier to see when somebody's doing a good coaching job at an under-the-radar school like that, necessarily, than some other places. By the way, I just looked this up. Dan Mullen's winning percentage at Mississippi State was 600. Do you want to guess what Jackie Sherrill's was?
I don't know.
500. The last coach to have a 600 record at Mississippi State, believe it or not, and I frankly either didn't know or forgotten that this person coached at Mississippi State, was Darryl Royal, 1954 to 50. It was only two seasons. But he posted
Do you know how many winning seasons in SEC play Dan Mullen had in 9 years?
I think one.
One.
Yeah.
So,
but again, if that were the case at, you know, LSU, you'd say the guy was a terrible coach. You base it based on relative to the historical level that program's usually at. And the last coaches before Dan Mullen were 356, 500, 382, 468. Emory Ballard, the inventor of the wishbone, couldn't crack 500 at Mississippi State, nor could Bob Tyler at 328, Charles Shearer at 270. So let me just count this up real quick. Before Dan Mullen, the last nine coaches had not gone above 500.
By the way, where did you have James Franklin on your list again?
15th.
So wait a minute. You're giving me all this stuff about how great a job Dan Mullen did at Mississippi State, and yet you have James Franklin beneath him. Why don't you go rattle off what coaches have done at Vanderbilt and compare to what James Franklin did, and then explain how you have James Franklin 15 and Dan Mullen 13.
Okay, world's biggest James Franklin fan. There's actually a question about that later in our mailbag that you might want to get to.
Explain it, though.
Well, this person that I'm going to read the question of thinks we both have him too high. Why do I have Mullen ahead of James Franklin? I think that Franklin I had him higher last year. This was a bit of a ho-hum season this past season, so maybe I dropped
They finished 17th. They lost Saquon Barkley. I mean, it wasn't a great year, but it's not like they were like 5-7
There's
either.
One criticism of my list, and you made it, that's probably valid, is that despite my own warning in the lead... Too much recency bias on one season in particular, in this last season. Yeah, probably should have Franklin ahead of Mullen. It's not like it was a big difference, but yes, probably should have him above. Now let's.
Saying if you're using the logic of, well, look at all the other coaches there. I mean, the gap between James Franklin, and this is gonna I'm gonna use So the question you're referring to is Donnie Green. What if I told you there was a coach in the top 15 on both your lists who in the last five seasons was 5-12 versus ranked teams, 3-12 in the biggest conference rivals, one game over 500 on the road? Who would you guess?
2-3 in bowl games.
2-3 in bowl games. James Franklin. That doesn't seem top 15 to me. Yes, he won a conference title at Penn State, and don't take that away from him. But I still see a coach who had surprising misleading numbers at Vanderbilt and a generational type talent in Saquon Barkley. The numbers, in my opinion, aren't great. And as Bruce mentioned, many consider him a poor game coach. Please tell me what I'm missing here. Okay, Donnie, I'm going to tell you what you're missing. First of all, the generational talent you're talking, Saquon Barkley, he was going to Rutgers till James Franklin got to Penn State. So you got to give him credit for that. Saquon Barkley didn't just show up. Second of all, I don't want to hear about the numbers are misleading at Vanderbilt, because they were god-awful before he got there. They were god-awful right before he got there. So it's not like he took in some, like, you know, Coach O was there and recruiting his butt off, and then all of a sudden he inherited those players. They were terrible before that. And by the way, after he left, they haven't had a winning season since after he left. So there's that. So if you want to say, oh, he was a really good recruiter, and, you know, he's recruited better by any kind of measure than Bill O'Brien did. It's just like he won with somebody else's players. And then, all right, so now he's gotten at Penn State. He not only won a conference, he, by the way, was a pretty loaded division that he won, right? I mean, you have Urban Meyer, Jim Harbaugh, and Mark D'Antonio in that division. Those are some heavyweight dudes. And they were all, you know, pretty much at the peak of where they're at. And he won the Big Ten. So I'm sorry. You can tell me about if we want to do like what he is against ranked team and whatnot in some of this numbers, then I should put Coach O in the top 25. You know, this is, you can nitpick the numbers a little bit, but I mean, I'm going to argue this one for till the cows come home. I mean, the Vanderbilt thing is a real thing. And then you go to what he's done at Penn State. And if he finishing 17th this past year was a big blemish, I think Penn State fans should be okay with that.
I can't explain it, but even back when he was still at Vanderbilt, there was this.
Yeah, he didn't win the big game. Well,
yeah, there was all this
State.
Like trying to discredit it because it was coming because the 9-win seasons were coming against, you know, the lesser opponents on the schedule. Well, you know that game we just played comparing previous winning percentages? This gets really fun. Okay, James Franklin had a 6.15 overall winning percentage. I won't even focus on that. 4.58, 11-13 in the SEC. Okay, so somebody's going to look at that and go, oh, he didn't even get to 500, and he's playing Kentucky and South Tennessee when they were bad. Okay, well, let's see how his predecessors did in the SEC. Robbie Caldwell, 125. Bobby Johnson, 188. People have a lot of respect for Bobby Johnson, and he went 12-52 in the SEC there. And then before that, 100, poor Rod Dauhauer went .063. Our friend Jerry DiNardo, .290. Watson Brown, 121. George, you got to go back to find somebody who went 458 in the SEC, you have to go back to Ray Morrison, who went 544 from 1935 to 1939. All right, end of debate. Debate over.
Yeah, and the one other misleading thing that, you know, you're underscoring about Vanderbilt, some of the criticism was, oh, beat anybody good. Well, then he got to Penn State, and they beat Ohio State. You know, and so it's like, and then, oh, they won on a blocked kick. Sorry, that matters.
That
you know,
counts.
So, yeah. This question is from Kevin Denson. Gentlemen, while I appreciate the great work you two do as ambassadors of college football, the results of your coaching ranking had me scratching my head. I think that you are attempting to judge coaches in the abstract of their coaching ability. However, it appears to be a slant towards coaches of programs with lesser talent. For example, you ranked coaches such as Chris Peterson, David Shaw, and Gary Patterson highly for their ability to maximize the potential of their players and compete against the more talented teams. However, it is very unlikely that the respective programs will be talented enough to ever win a national title. The component that you seem to underrate is the ability to recruit. Jimbo Fisher coached FSU to a championship and is in the process of making Texas A&M a perennial contender, yet he's ranked behind Chris Peterson, whose most notable accomplishment is winning the Pac-12 title. Similar comparisons could be made with James Franklin against David Shaw. Thanks, Kevin Denson. Stu, What do you think?
Well, first of all, I'm going to guess that Kevin is an A&M fan because I love how he's been there. Jimbo's been there 1 year, and they're already talking about it as if it's a done deal. He's making A&M a perennial contender. I don't necessarily deny that I probably give more credit to guys who maximize the potential of their players, win a lot of games with 2 and 3 stars, because that is a very clear example of this was your coaching ability. Whereas, you know, how do you judge a guy like Jimbo Fisher who, you know, he won a national championship. That's the single most important thing a coach can do. He recruited, there's no question, he recruited great classes at Florida State. But again, this was at Florida State. It's a lot different deal trying to, like, are you really going to knock David Shaw that he doesn't sign top 5 recruiting classes at Stanford? Florida State was recruiting those kind of classes long before Jimbo got there and will continue to long after Jimbo leaves because there's so much talent in the state of Florida. And no offense, Florida State, but probably a little easier to get in there than to Stanford. Chris Peterson did this not just at Washington, but at Boise State. So I think you have to take that into account where they're coaching. And then the only other thing I'd say, Jimbo, and I'm not turning this into a Jimbo, not Jimbo session, because I do have him in the top 10, as do you, but why do people just gloss over what happened at the end of Florida State? We had a friend of ours, Ralph Russo from the AP, texting us about all the things he disagreed with, and he too thought Jimbo should be higher. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Yeah, I won the national championship, had a great run there with Jameis, but now, like, that program is a dumpster fire, and he left it that way.
Yeah, and I don't think we had, like, where did, I had Jimbo 5? Where did you have him? 7?
7, yeah.
So, I don't know.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I looked at Kevin's comment. I really, again, he mentioned Jimbo, so, like, we'll see. I mean, this is the second place he's coached. He had a nice first year. We'll see how it turns out. I mean, the three guys he mentioned, I mean, to me, what Gary Patterson's done there, and I think you have to use it some as a measuring stick of what the place was like before he was there and what the arc of it is like. I mean, like you said, you go 9-4 at Mississippi State, they're going to want to build a statue for you every year. You go 9-4 at LSU or Oklahoma, and they're going to want to run you out of there. So I do think there's got to be, and certain places are more resourced than others. You know, it's just different there. Certainly your alma mater fits that with Pat Fitzgerald.
By the way, Gary Patterson might not have a national championship, but he did take what was then a Mountain West program to an undefeated season and a Rose Bowl win over a top 5 Wisconsin team. Like, yeah. It's pretty good.
Yes.
All right, moving away from coaching rankings to John R. from Houston, Texas. A question about the Missouri Bowl ban. Since the CFP is not under the NCAA, why does the NCAA postseason ban have an effect on Mizzou getting chosen for the CFP? Well, unlikely, if Mizzou went undefeated next year, couldn't the committee choose them as one of the top 4 teams anyway, or are the affiliated bowl games bound by the NCAA? That is a great question. Yes, the bowl games, in particular the ones in the semifinal, which this year will be the Fiesta Bowl and the Peach Bowl, are, while they're not run by the NCAA, they are NCAA-certified events. So if you're banned from the postseason, you would be banned from those bowl games. What I don't know, Bruce, because it hasn't come up yet, is, you know, is Mizzou ineligible from the committee's rankings? You know, if Mizzou is 8-1 the week that they do the first rankings, are they just not going to show up in that? I actually don't know.
Well,
the answer.
Wouldn't they be? Because you still have to use them as a metric for other opponents and certainly SEC teams, right?
Well, the AP does include teams like, for instance, Ohio State and Urban Meyer's first year.
But the AP doesn't matter in this case.
Right, I'm just saying for comparison's sake, the AP does it. The coaches poll does not include those teams. But you're right, if you're going to sit there and say,
because to me that's why it's relevant.
Georgia is 3-1 against the top 25, you know, then you can't not have, and Missouri is supposed to be one of them, then you can't not have them in there. That's a great, so I think you're right. I think they have to rank them. Boy, that would be really awkward if the first time Mizzou actually has a playoff contender that you're just like, all right, well, they're, you get on that conference call and they're like, well, we ranked them 7th, but just skip past them. It's a great question. I need to ask somebody that.
All right.
Okay, our next one comes from Robbie Cook, and it's a little bit involved, but follow along, Bruce. Hey, Stu and Bruce, I've had a question for quite a while. Why is Nebraska widely considered to be a sleeping giant on a national or at least consistent top 15 scale, but the usual opinion about Tennessee is, quote, just be happy if you go 8-4 regularly because you're never going to be on the level of Auburn, Florida, LSU, the 90s are over. Despite both programs having relatively little success since the 90s, Tennessee having better facilities, I don't know if they do or not, larger stadium, that they do, more desirable to city to live in with nicer weather. Max Olson may disagree, Lincoln native Max Olson. Larger fan base, I don't know about that. Nebraska is about as rabid and large a fan base as they come. Significantly higher athletic department budget, that is true. What do you think? Do you consider them both to be sleeping giants, or neither, or one and not the other?
You know what? I think they're fairly similar, and I think one thing that helped Nebraska out profile-wise in the last decade is that it went into the much more favorable division or side of the Big Ten. It's not in the Ohio State, Michigan, Penn State, Michigan State side. It's in the place where Wisconsin is basically ruled, with a little help from certainly Iowa. And Nebraska profile-wise, why couldn't they do that? I think part of why maybe there's a little more juice behind the Nebraska talk as far as Tennessee. Tennessee was really good under Phil Fulmer. Nebraska was great under Tom Osborne. And I think so, because they were all just, I think they were even a notch above in terms of the level of success they had. It wasn't just one national title. It was just an amazing run they had. So I think there's probably a little bit more of that, as you know, on his list. I don't know if I would say the, you know, I've been to Nebraska and I've been to Tennessee. I don't know if I would agree that they have better facilities. I don't know if I buy that. The larger stadium, I think both have really unique game day atmospheres and really passionate fan bases. So I don't know about that. You know, weather, yeah, I'll give you weather is better. I don't know in terms of this, and this is a nitpicky thing, because I'm not sure I look at Nebraska. I see USC or what Texas has been, you know, till Tom Herman got it going. Those to me are sleeping giants. I think Nebraska and Tennessee both should be consistent top 25 teams if the head coach is doing it right. But when I look at Nebraska, I just, in terms of in your division, there should be nobody who is any better position than you are. Whereas at Tennessee, you just don't have quite the level of recruiting base as Florida, as Georgia. You're clearly behind those two. And so if we're being nitpicky, I would say that's the difference, but I don't know if I would consider either a huge difference over the other.
I think the sentiment he's picking up on has probably just been the case since Scott Frost got there. I mean, since Scott Frost got there, everybody's really jazzed up about Nebraska. But in general, you know, I think I hear much more frequently, well, they're never going to get back to the glory days in the 90s. They're not going to win national titles. They are too geographically isolated. And I think Tennessee, if all things being equal in terms of the coaches, and you know, I'm not ruling out Jeremy Pruitt, but right now, obviously, Scott Frost is a little more proven and just has more hype around him. I actually think Tennessee's in a little better position to get back to contending for national titles, just because, you know, yeah, the state itself is not a huge recruiting state, but they're in driving distance of a lot of places that are, whereas Nebraska's, you know, kind of out there in the middle of heartland and needs to, you know, go into Texas and go into California, whereas Tennessee can go into the Southeast. And the other thing I would say is something pretty significant changed since the 90s for Nebraska, which is the system that was their whole identity under Tom Osborne. It's just, they're not running it anymore. No, you know, nobody but you know, Paul Johnson and the service academies are. So they've had to completely reinvent themselves. I don't know that anything has really tangibly changed for Tennessee other than they've had a really bad run of coaches.
You know? I can tell you one thing that has changed for Tennessee since the decline of, at the end of Fulmer and then the last decade. Dabo Sweeney's happened.
Yeah,
they're
that's
really
a good
close,
one.
And they are a recruiting machine, and kids want to go there. And I'm not saying Tennessee is the biggest loser in the, well, a major powerhouse has risen up to a level it really hasn't been at in a long, long time. But I think that does impact them somewhat, because impacts everybody around that area, certainly them. What's interesting, by the way, is, and I think you hit on a really good point, why the Scott Frost factor is because Scott Frost took a program that was horrific and hadn't won a game and turned him into one that went 12-0 at UCF, and he's proven, whereas Jeremy Pruitt is not. So if you have this situation where it would be, I think it would be different if Jeff Brohm had taken the Tennessee job or Mike Leach speech, or somebody who was a more established proven commodity. Jeremy Pruitt, we'll see. Nobody really knows. He just had a good recruiting class, but you know, Butch Jones had good recruiting classes. There's just not enough track record for anybody to say complete buy-in. What is you know, how they're connected? The franchise quarterback that I think will eventually lead Nebraska to a Western Division title in the Big Ten was committed for a long time to Tennessee, Adrian Martinez, and basically ended up going to Nebraska. And I think that was a huge shift. And I'm not saying Tennessee can't win games because he didn't end up going there. There's other quarterbacks they can get. But I think that was a very interesting 180 there.
There is one other thing I should say in terms of how it affected Tennessee, much like you brought up Clemson. You know, I think back to the 90s, Florida was every bit, they were Tennessee's foil. They were their nemesis. But Georgia, that was not the high point of Georgia football in the 90s. And Tennessee at that time got a lot of their best players from the state of Georgia. Now you've got Kirby Smart there trying to like build a fence around the state. That makes it a little bit harder. Now, Jeremy Pruitt, they hired him because he's such a great recruiter. And, you know, he should, you know, if all things go well, he should be able to get back some of those kids that would have otherwise signed with Georgia or signed with Clemson. But, you know, grand scheme of things, there's plenty of talent out. There's no reason. This line he had about if you can go 8-4, you should be happy. If you go 8-4 regularly, I would think the only people saying that are like their rival fans. There's no reason Tennessee can't be a 10-2 team regularly that rises up and plays for the SEC championship, just like there's no reason Nebraska can't be that team, especially coming out of the Big Ten West.
Yeah, and in the reality, though, of that 9-4 or what, 8-4 thing, I mean, they got tired of Butch Jones after he couldn't get better than he had a couple of 9-4s. He was on the hot seat and then the bottom foul. So I think the expectations are very real, very high there. I mean, look, Bo Pelini got fired after a bunch of 9-4 kind of years. Now, some of that was, a lot of that was, I think, his temperament and the persona had to do with it, too, though.
All right. Finally, Bruce, remember last week somebody wrote in asking, is it Middle Tennessee or Middle Tennessee State? And I kind of half jokingly said, like, maybe their SID will write in. Well, he didn't, but one of the other schools from Conference USA did. Jordan Stepp, the SID at North Texas, whose name shows up in my inbox pretty much every day during football season. Hey, Stu and Bruce, hope you're well. Just listened to your latest episode of the Audible and wanted to pass along what I know about the appropriate terminology for Middle Tennessee. I have attached a document that's an official document from Conference USA to answer the question. If you're talking about the university, it is Middle Tennessee State University. If you're referring to the football program, it's Middle Tennessee with abbreviations for stat abbreviations, MT or MTSU. It is definitely confusing, but we refer to them on schedules, in stories, on graphics as Middle Tennessee, and I've never had my counterparts in Murfreesboro ask us to switch that up. So there
That's
you go.
Good.
We have resolved it. Middle Tennessee, in our world, they're Middle Tennessee. In academia, they are Middle Tennessee State University.
Can we get an answer on Bucharest? No.
That one we could probably Google. Are you ready for March Madness, my friend? By the time we come back on this podcast next week, brackets will be out.
March Madness? And Becky's in the middle of an FBI sting. How much more madness can we get?
It's the most wonderful time of the year. I will admit I have watched less college basketball this year than at any point since I became a sports fan, but I'm still looking forward to the tournament. And I'm guessing
our audience is not listening to us for college basketball.
No, we will not. Still. We will not shower you with... I don't do bracketology anymore. I think when I did, that would occasionally pop up on here. And then a couple weeks, I'll be hitting the road for spring football. I know you will as well. So it'll be cool to get out there and see some teams and be able to report some actual firsthand nuggets here back on the podcast.
All right, Stu, what's the mailbag address?
You tell me, my friend.
Let's see if you forgot.
You want to see I've forgotten the mailbag address?
Yes, yes.
It's the audiblepod@gmail.com.
Good one, Stu. Okay.
We'll see you next time.
If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to the Audible on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review while you're at it. It helps get the word out. Thanks to Trader Joe's for being our presenting sponsor. Our producer is Nick Fink. Our theme song is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octave. You can download their music on iTunes and Spotify. Follow me, Stu, at SL Mandel on Twitter, and Bruce at Bruce Feldman CFB, and subscribe to The Athletic if you haven't done so already. You can try it for free, 7-day free trial at theathletic.com/free trial. So come on, get over it.